Bonjour et toutes et tous. My name is Suzanne Morton and I am the acting director of the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada. I'd like to welcome you all here today to the J.R. Mallory Lecture in Canadian Studies. We're particularly pleased to have Elizabeth May delivering a lecture, The Crisis in Democracy. I'm going to begin by sharing a little information with you about J.R. Mallory and the Mallory Lecture. J.R. Mallory was professor of political science here. He was born in 1916 in St. Andrews, New Brunswick, and was educated at the University of New Brunswick, Dalhousie, and Edinburgh. His career took him to Saskatchewan, Toronto, Brandon, and McGill, where he served for 45 years and was chairman of the Economics and Political Science Department for 10 years. After retiring in 1982, he was appointed professor emeritus and continued to teach for another 10 years. Professor Mallory passed away in 2003. The endowment for the J.R. Mallory Lecture in Canadian Studies was established in January 1995, and the lecture has featured such renowned speakers as Bob Ray, Alain Dubec, Tom Kent, John Gomery, Chantal Hébert, Andrew Cohen, and Noah Richler. It has been a tradition for us so many years, and we're happy to have Professor Mallory's son, Charles, along with Charles's wife, Dorothy Levine, here with us today. Charles will introduce this afternoon's Mallory lecture, and so you'll get a chance to meet him. Before I invite Dean Manfredi to introduce Charles, I'd like to mention that the McGill Institute has a number of events coming up. This time next week, we're really delighted to host Dr. Cheryl Suzik and Dr. Bruce Gautreau, who will deliver the Ekin Lecture and help us launch our Indigenous Studies program. We're also pleased that the McGill Fulbright Research Fellow, Cam Terwiger, is going to be giving us a talk in April. Please consult our website for more information. I hope you enjoy the lecture. Professor Dean Manfredi.
Merci. Merci, Suzanne. Ça me fait un grand plaisir de vous présenter à Charles Mallory, le fils de J.R. Mallory. Et je suis honoré d'avoir le privilège d'être doyen de la Faculté des Arts. Charles Mallory is the younger son of James Mallory. He was born in, and the year is given to me, but I'll skip that, but he was born in the year after his father was appointed a professor here at McGill. And McGill was a part of his upbringing. He remembers this very room where from his early childhood there were annual Christmas parties, and there still are, I believe. And he remembers the political science offices in Purvis Hall at the time, before the Leacock Building was built, almost in time for his arrival as an undergraduate at McGill. After graduating in 1970, Charles went to work in the cabinet secretariat of Ed Schreyer in Manitoba, or more specifically, he went to work for one of his professors, Jack Weldon, whom Schreyer had appointed as his secretary for planning that same year. His 2 years there were very valuable in his next line of work as an environmental militant. Active with numerous groups back in Montreal, Charles, with his familiarity with how governments tend to see things, became something of a front man for the environmental movement. With a home base as president of the local group STOP, Charles was nominated to act as the organizer for Quebec as a part of the National Steering Committee of the Canadian Environmental Network. He held this post for 6 years, during which time the network grew from about 60 groups to over 2,000 nationwide, with 400 from Quebec. It was, of course, in that capacity that he got to know tonight's speaker, Elizabeth May. In 1986, he was appointed to the National Task Force on Environment and Economy, formed in response to the Brundtland World Commission on Environment and Development, and which led to the creation of the National Roundtable on the Environment and the Economy. In 1982, he met his wife, Dorothy Levine, who is here with us this afternoon, and went back to graduate school in 1984, completing his master's and PhD at the Université de Montréal in Environmental Economics. Charles then taught economics for a couple of years at Concordia University before joining the federal government in 1991. He spent his first 9 years at Consulting and Audit Canada, the government's full-cost recovery internal consulting agency. By chance, as finding employment was not so easy in those years either, That was the year after the conservative government of the day introduced the Green Plan, and the agency was looking for an economist who knew something about the environment. There were not a lot of candidates. 3 years after being named practice leader of economic and regulatory services, he transferred to Health Canada, where he was named director of health policy research, a post he held until his retirement from the public service in 2009. Since then, he has worked part-time as a private consultant. Over my 8 years as dean, it's been a pleasure to get to know Charles and Dorothy very well, and I treasure their friendship, and I welcome Charles here today to introduce our speaker.
Bonsoir tout le monde. J'ai écrit mon texte en anglais, donc je vais le lire plutôt en anglais. Mais those of you who have come to the Mallory Lecture in any of the last few years, there isn't a light on here, is there? Oh, that's an on switch, it just doesn't go on. So any of the last few years will have seen my wife Dorothy and me comfortably seated near the front with gracious acknowledgement from the dean and the director of the institute. And from time to time, my brother has been able to make it as well. Before that, of course, I was at the side of my father until his death in 2003. And he and my mother had moved to Ottawa the year after I was hired by the federal government. And in his later years, as he grew a bit feeble, I would accompany him down from Ottawa to hear the speakers. In those years, my mother was already too uncomfortable to make the trip at all. Today, I play a different role, one that I'm very happy about and proud to fulfill, and this is to introduce my old comrade in arms, Elizabeth May, this year's Mallory Lecturer. As related in her book, How to Save the World in Your Spare Time, Elizabeth May quite literally learned how to be an activist at her mother's knee. Born in 19... Well, I should... It's actually part of the public record, I think. There was a dispute. There was when Pierre Trudeau was elected Prime Minister. There was a... Apparently, there were some inconsistencies when he was alleged to have been born. But anyway, Elizabeth is... much younger than I, born in 1954, spent her early days in Connecticut. Her mother became vitally concerned about atmospheric nuclear testing and the effect it might have on her children. Her parents formed the two-person Connecticut Committee for a Sane Nuclear Policy. They worked very hard, writing petitions and making phone calls, doing all the things that you would need to do to make a grassroots organization effective. One thing led to another, so to speak, so that by the time Elizabeth was 8, the American government had stopped atmospheric nuclear testing. Elizabeth learned a lot from her mother, including, as she puts it, "My mom changed the world, so can I." In 1972, the year Nixon was elected, I'm not sure how much of a coincidence that is, her parents moved to Cape Breton Island. The Mays did not leave their environmental activism behind. In 1975, when the Nova Scotia government approved aerial spraying in a vain effort to control spruce budworm, Elizabeth helped form the Cape Breton Landowners Against the Spray. When the government reapproved the spraying of the chemical mix known as Agent Orange in 1982, she launched an action with 16 others to stop the spray while she was still in law school at Dalhousie University. Pitted against the resources of a large multinational corporation, things did not go well. While the group won an initial injunction, they lost at trial, the court finding, not just in favor of Scott Paper, but that Agent Orange was safe and that it had not even caused problems in Vietnam. Forced to pay for the company's costs, most of the plaintiffs gave up the case, but not before Elizabeth May had gained international attention and, of course, renown within the environmental movement in Canada. In 1982, Environment Canada had asked me to put together a workshop on the management of toxic substances. I asked Elizabeth and Kathy Richards from New Brunswick to make a presentation. There were federal government representatives there from both Environment Canada and Agriculture Canada. I'd like to note, in rereading my summary comments at the beginning of the report, I was hopeful that the workshop marked the beginning of a new era in the management of toxic substances, building on the lines of communication that had been established with the government. I noted, however, that the government would need to follow through with some concrete actions. In the last few years, need I say, there have been a sharp reversal in the government's interest in collaborating with citizens' groups or dealing with any of these issues at all. On graduation from law school, Elizabeth moved to Ottawa, taking a position as Associate General Counsel with the Public Interest Advocacy Center. She also helped found the Canadian Environmental Defense Fund. In 1986, Elizabeth accepted a position as Senior Policy Advisor to the Minister of the Environment, Tom McMillan. The Mulroney Conservatives were quite different from what we see today. In those same years, I was working with Minister McMillan on the National Task Force on Environment and Economy, appointed by the Canadian Council of Ministers of the Environment in the context of the Brundtland World Commission on Environment and Development. Not to say, of course, that the government was perfectly enlightened. In 1988, Elizabeth felt obliged to resign when the minister illegally granted permits for dams on the Souris River in Saskatchewan without environmental assessments. Back in the activist milieu, Elizabeth was appointed executive director of the Sierra Club of Canada the next year. Incidentally, this was the group that David Brower left some 20 years earlier to form Friends of the Earth, because the recreational mountain climbers didn't want to become activists. They changed course before long, and the Sierra Club is well known as an aggressive defender on environmental issues. I won't go into details of all the actions Elizabeth undertook while with the Sierra Club, but I do wish to note that she's the author of 7 books. I've already mentioned How to Save the World in Your Spare Time, and she also wrote Budworm Battles based on her struggle in Cape Breton. While still with the Sierra Club, she wrote Paradise Won, about the defense of the South Moresby Forest, At the Cutting Edge, now in its 2nd edition, and Frederick Street, co-authored with Maud Barlow, about the disaster of the Sydney tar ponds. Elizabeth also wrote with Zoe Caron, Global Warming for Dubbies. Probably there isn't one of us who's not heard, if not said, sometime this winter, which is still with us, where is global warming when you need it? But remember, it was unseasonably warm in Sochi, so I guess the jet stream is not with us this year. In her 7th book, Losing Confidence, Elizabeth relates a story from November 2005, largely forgotten by most of us. The day Harper, Layton, and Doucette announced their deal to bring down the government of Paul Martin was the opening day of the 11th Conference of the Parties on the Kyoto Protocol, hosted by Canada in the person of Stéphane Dion, here in Montreal. It was a key meeting, being the first by the ratifying parties under the protocol. Their timing was just right to push what might seem to have been a liberal coup on the environment off the front pages. And in the campaign that followed, the NDP abandoned its support for action to reduce climate change, sidestepping the issue and focusing instead on the sponsorship scandal. Harper, of course, won a minority and Canada withdrew Canada's support for Kyoto. But the NDP had proven itself wanting, not the first time, but on the environment front. And in 2006, Elizabeth ran for and won the leadership of the Green Party of Canada. She was elected to Parliament in 2008 as the first member of that party. I don't think I can exaggerate the importance my father attached to the role of Member of Parliament. It is not difficult for me to dig out a couple of quotes without any pretense that I was one of his best students. Some 50 years ago, in 1963, he wrote, "Under our system of cabinet government, it is the legislature which is the democratic nucleus, for the popularly elected legislature is the only part of the government chosen by and responsible to the people." He continued, "Under responsible government is the elected commons which chooses, in quotes, the government by giving a government authority, by sustaining it and thus making stable government possible, and by withdrawing confidence from a government which no longer deserves to rule. This is the House of Commons' most important function. However, by 1980, my father used more circumspect language to describe this role. The modern evolution of the Westminster system of government has left Parliament with an ambiguous and little understood role. Strict party discipline means that once a government has a majority, it is safe until it terminates the life of the House of Commons and goes back to the electorate. Gone, or nearly gone, are the days when one could say, with Walter Bagehot, that the House is a permanent electoral chamber which can create or destroy a government when it chooses to do so. When this actually happens, as in December 1979, of course that was the year before he wrote, and we've seen other examples, just spoke of one, it is a cause of general wonderment and simulated resentment. Well, in fact, in 2005 it was more than simulated resentment, of course, something of a so-called constitutional crisis, and stimulated resentment that the House had deprived a government of its mandate to govern for a, quote, full term. No less than others, such as Donald Savoy, my father saw early how power was being pulled to the center, and he resented it. As he wrote, the House simply legitimates what somebody else has already given to it as a finished product. Every serious student of the parliamentary system agrees that the performance of the House of Commons and provincial chambers must be improved. In fact, they must improve if a proper balance be restored to our political institutions. It's my emphasis. I think that one of the most remarkable things about Elizabeth May is her unquenchable optimism. Just reading from her books is enough to drive one to despair. Think of the excesses of cutthroat capitalism and supine governments that allowed the situation of the Sydney tar ponds to develop and then get completely out of hand. Or the forest industry, where Elizabeth is not just a storyteller, but a victim of some of those same merciless forces. But Elizabeth does not go overboard in her criticisms. She manages to stay level-headed and focus on how things can be improved. Almost always, that recipe involves all of us. As I have been known to say, democracy is not a right, but a duty. Or, as she has written, making a democracy work requires effective citizenship. It is not enough to vote every few years. It is not even enough to send a check now and then to an environmental or anti-poverty group. Making democracy work is work. And now I give you Elizabeth May.
Merci. Thank you. Il me fait un plaisir énorme d'être ici, un grand honneur pour moi d'être ici pour cet événement très important dans la vie de l'Université McGill. In honor of the father of my friend Charles Mallory, and what a lovely small world moment it is for us, as you can tell. We're old friends. We haven't seen each other for a long time, and, you know, neither of us have changed at all. We are both, you know, young activists, living in the delusion that we are young activists. But James Mallory, of course, stood, and as Charles's quotes illustrate, how much I hope I'm taking up the cudgel in the cause that he cared about in terms of the respect for our institutions, respect for parliamentary democracy, and what's been happening in Canada. So I want to start by thanking the McGill Institute for the study of Canada. I want to thank Dean Manfredi for his words and Professor Morton for hers in giving me this opportunity to address the crisis in Canadian democracy. Parce que je pense que c'est vraiment une crise, c'est une crise énorme, c'est une question d'urgence de mettre sur pied les solutions pour améliorer cette solution, parce que c'est vraiment grave. I was thinking a lot about how to put forward this academic context of a lecture, and I want to do my very best to make it nonpartisan. And that's difficult because certain political developments will appear, as I describe them, to put in sharp focus some of the activities of our current Prime Minister. But as I've done in a number of my books, I want to make it clear that what we're seeing here are trends, and trends that are dangerous. And so I'm going to use a bit of a milestone in terms of my evolution of thought about what kind of crisis we're experiencing in Canadian democracy. My last book, I have a new book coming out in the fall that will pick up where this left off. But a lot of how I feel about what's happening to democracy, all those years that Charles and I worked together, in the environmental movement, even going back to Nova Scotia trying to fight budworm spraying, we had a government that listened. Like, how to save the world in your spare time is a guidebook for activists of how to organize and mobilize to get elected decision makers to listen to you and to a movement and to respond appropriately. It's a primer in citizen effectiveness. It's, you know, do your research, put together the case, you mobilize your case, you talk to the public, you do a media campaign, you go to an elected official, and they will listen when they realize both that you figured out the alternatives, that your case makes sense, and that you have a lot of Canadians behind you that could affect the electoral results, right? That's not true anymore. None of it's true anymore. It's like a Monty Python sketch of the dead parrot. Democracy is nailed to its little perch. And I could tell you that if we mobilize and educate and explain very patiently that our case is correct on the facts, that will carry the day, because it was true. When I believed it, when I preached it, when I worked on it, it was true. It could be true again, but it's not true right now. So let me back up and say that the other day, in my home riding, and I'm terribly fortunate that the voters of Saanich Gulf Islands were so brave as to defeat a sitting Conservative cabinet minister to elect Canada's only Green Party member of Parliament, to sit in Parliament. It was a brave thing to do, and it's also a very, very, as you can imagine, active and engaged community. We had the highest voter turnout in Canada in the last election, 75% voter turnout that got me elected. And one of the hotbeds of activism within my riding is Salt Spring Island. And on Salt Spring Island, it's not the bulk of population, but it's a hotbed. And they have a forum, and they invite distinguished Canadians to speak. So just during this last parliamentary recess, March 12th, I think, that they invited one of my heroes, Canada's first parliamentary budget officer, Kevin Page, to come speak on Salt Spring Island. And Kevin Page is extraordinary. And he's one of a number of parliamentary heroes. We should spend a lot more time in this country right now paying homage to the people who've given up their careers in order to stick to trying to serve a public which no longer notices their sacrifice. You know, Monier Sheikh should be a name that every Canadian knows. Monier Sheikh, who grew up in a Pakistani orphanage, who achieved the highest level of academic excellence, going to the best schools in the world to come to Canada to achieve the pinnacle of his career, to be deputy minister responsible for Statistics Canada, and to resign on principle when the minister responsible for Statistics Canada lied to the Canadian public and said no one at Statistics Canada has said anything to suggest that it won't be just as effective to collect statistics once we get rid of the long-form census, right? Monier Sheikh resigned on principle. Kevin Page said, I'm not going to run for a second term. I'm not going to ask for my extension. I'll serve one term as parliamentary budget officer. There are a number of other names I could mention, by the way, in this litany of Canadian civil servants who've sacrificed: Linda Keane, Richard Colwyn, or right now Mark Mayrand, but I'll come back to the so-called Fair Elections Act in a moment. But when Kevin Page was speaking on Salt Spring, he cited a lyric from Bruce Coburn, with which I was not familiar. It's awfully good. It's from 1981, and Kevin Page said, well, you know, as Bruce Coburn says, the trouble with normal is it always gets worse. So here's what's becoming normal in Canada. When I left Sierra Club to run for leader of the Green Party, it was from that situation that Charles describes, taking us back to November 28, 2005, when the COP11 opened in Montreal, the government fell, we were into an election campaign, and the fact that COP11 succeeded in keeping Kyoto on track, in defeating the Bush administration, and getting a viable climate plan going, It was all ashes in our mouth by the end of January when Stephen Harper became Prime Minister and immediately, or virtually immediately, announced that Canada was repudiating our Kyoto targets. Canada's behavior on climate, by the way, is far worse than the measure of our tonnage of emissions. It's what we have done globally to sabotage progress internationally that is our largest offense. It's, in fact, criminal. But when I go back to that moment of November 28th, 2005, that was the moment when I began to think, oh boy, we could be in real trouble in this country. And it ended up, without going through every moment of it, with me deciding that I should leave Sierra Club and run for leader of the Green Party, because I realized that from a nonpartisan place like the Sierra Club of Canada, I couldn't say what needed to be said. But between when I left Sierra Club in the spring of 2006 and when I got through the 2008 election and then wrote this book, I saw for the first time the real crisis in Canadian democracy. I hadn't realized, I mean, I knew that first past the post was a perverse voting system, that any voting system that allowed the minority of Canadians to elect the majority of seats in a parliamentary government was disastrous for democracy, regardless of whether it was Mulroney who got a false majority. By the way, false majority is a term developed by Peter Russell, who's Professor Emeritus of Political Science at University of Toronto, one of Canada's leading academics and defenders of democracy, in the footsteps of Professor Mallory. So Peter Russell said these are false majorities when they happen. Now, a false majority should be offensive regardless of what party you support. So I knew we had a dysfunctional democracy in terms of first past the post. I had, before taking up my first party membership in my life, in spring of 2006, I joined the Green Party. First, I had to resign from Sierra Club so I could join a political party, so I could run for leader of that party. You can imagine exactly how unlikely this prospect seemed at the time. But in any case, I did all those things because I could see that democracy was in real trouble when environmental groups were silenced by threats of loss of charitable status, when political parties would turf principle for short-term electoral advantage, and when nobody was in that field to say, wait a minute, credit where credit's due. So-and-so did something good once. Let's give them credit for that. So I entered this fray thinking that if I played the role of, I don't know, somewhere between Mary Poppins and Goody Goody Two-Shoes, it would all help. So that was more or less my intent. When I wrote Losing Confidence, Power, Politics, and the Crisis in Canadian Democracy, I spelled out the things that I thought were signs in the way you do a health checkup, the indicators that Canadian democracy was on the ropes. One of them is low voter turnout, finding that fewer than 60% of Canadians were voting, as in the 2008 election. The use of attack ads. I describe attack ads in this book as a tool of voter suppression. The only reason that parties spend money on attack ads is to disgust the voting public enough that we hope they might not vote. That's what a political party that spends money on attack ads is hoping, that you won't vote. And it's described, you know, in the literature of the current how to win elections without actually winning the hearts and minds of the electorate, voter suppression is a key tool, and it's accepted by people who do this kind of barbarism for a living. People who don't actually believe in democracy, but think they know how to win elections while not believing in democracy. So this was on the rise. I talk about my book because there was a particularly good moment for me in terms of an aha moment. I was doing an interview with Michael Enright on the CBC Sunday Morningside program, and his other guest was one of my favorite journalists who cared about these issues, the late James Travers. And I'd known Jim Travers from when he'd been on the editorial board of the Ottawa Citizen. We were old friends, but here we were in this setting, me in one studio and him in another. And Michael Enright said, okay, Elizabeth, what do you think is, why do you say there's a crisis? Isn't that overblown rhetoric? What crisis in Canadian democracy? I spelled out some of the things I've just mentioned to you. I think I may have thrown in that the RCMP interfered in the 2008 election and no one seemed to care that the state police had actually thrown the election to a party that they liked. Didn't seem to get many people upset. And then Michael Enright turned to James Travers and said, well, Jim, is she exaggerating? Is there a crisis in Canadian democracy? And I'm paraphrasing because I don't have a tape of this, but Jim Travers said, oh, no, not at all. As a matter of fact, I think she's understating the case. He said, oh, you can still visit Ottawa these days. And what you'll find is a democracy theme park. All the buildings are there and you can tour them. And it might create the impression that democracy is going on, but I assure you it isn't. Now that was before, as I said, the trouble with normal is it always gets worse. Right, so after the 2008 election, that was before we had the second prorogation. The first prorogation I wrote about in my book, that's before we had the second prorogation. First prorogation prompted Keith Spicer to write, "The world finally pays attention to Canada, and what do they get? Zimbabwe run by the Queen." Second prorogation. So the second prorogation, Ned Franks, professor emeritus, political science from Queens, commented we should now refer to Stephen Harper as King Stephen I of Canada, because that's what's just happened. This was before, my book came out before the finding of contempt by Peter Milliken, that the Harper administration was withholding from parliamentarians information to which we were entitled to receive relating to the Afghan detainee documents. Small footnote, by the way, those documents have never been presented to Parliament, even though the last election took place based on the contempt verdict of Peter Milliken that those documents should be revealed. This was before the widespread use of robocalls to send voters to the wrong polling stations. Now, as things got worse, I kept looking at this and thinking, well, how much worse can it get? By the end of the 2011 election, I'd won my seat, and I was momentarily happy. Actually, I wasn't happy, because even before I found out I'd won, the first thing that happened when I emerged from wherever I was with my daughter to find out how the election returns were going, they finally unveiled for British Columbians what was going on in the rest of the country, and Chris Brown from CBC News said to me, "What do you think of the Harper majority?" And I said, well, that's not possible. Well, you see, it was a bad night, except for me winning my seat from my perspective. It wasn't enough for me to win my seat for me to be happy about the outcome. What I've seen since with a false majority is that even the last vestiges of respect for parliamentary institutions is falling away. Now, this is where things get deeply dangerous. I could barely believe it when I saw what started to happen with a majority. We had seen omnibus budget bills only from Stephen Harper, by the way. There's a lot of nonsense out there. This was normal practice. You know, again, the problem with normal, trouble with normal is it always gets worse. No, there'd been the occasional omnibus budget bill under previous administrations, but they never went more than about 100 pages, and they were relatively related to the budget. Now, that's an important little preamble there. The budget omnibus bills in the past had been about the budget. Stephen Harper changed that in 2009. It was an 800-page omnibus budget bill in 2009 that took aim at a couple of things, including the National Energy Board, including some changes to the Navigable Waters Act. The 2010 omnibus budget bill started doing some real damage to the Canadian Environmental Assessment Act. But it wasn't until the omnibus budget bill, C-38, of the spring of 2012, that we saw an omnibus budget bill that's probably best described as a widespread act of vandalism, showed no mercy towards those architectures, basically. The architecture of environmental law was destroyed in C-38. National Roundtable abolished, the Fisheries Act eviscerated, the Canadian Environmental Assessment Act repealed. By the fall of 2012, we had the destruction of the Navigable Waters Protection Act, and we're getting these budgetary omnibus bills are a significant assault on Parliament. It's also worth describing, although it's not been in any of the major national newspapers, that only recently has the firewall that used to exist between the Privy Council office and the Prime Minister's office come down. Now, a lot of you study public policy. I'm hoping that the Privy Council office isn't a topic that you haven't covered, but because I know this is being live streamed, and goodness knows if people listening know anything about Privy Council Office and why it's important. The Privy Council Office is essentially the deputy minister to the Prime Minister. As the Prime Minister's office has expanded, it didn't exist right before 1972. Pierre Trudeau created the idea of a Prime Minister's office. Tom Kent, who I'm honored to be a distinguished lecturer at the Mallory Lecture, knowing that Tom Kent was one of your lecturers, Tom Kent was principal secretary in the government of Lester B. Pearson. He described the Prime Minister's office in those days as being a handful of file clerks and a stenographer. There was no PMO, almighty control station of everything that happens in Ottawa. Now, when Pierre Trudeau created PMO, it was not the control station of everything that happened. It was at most light coordination among ministers. I describe it in my last book, Losing Confidence, based on things that I found from Tom Axworthy. Tom Axworthy, who's now professor at Queen's in Kingston, talked about his time as a young guy going to work in Pierre Trudeau's PMO and being told to go over and politely let the Minister of Justice, John Turner, know that the day he was going to do something conflicted with a press conference by somebody else. It was some sort of light massaging of the calendar. And John Turner turned on Tom Axworthy and said, go back and tell Pierre Trudeau that I don't need some junior G-man from the PMO coming in here and tell me what to do. Well, things have changed a lot since then. The Prime Minister's office, and it's now, it was up about to about a, just about $10 million a year budget under Stephen Harper. It shrank a bit last year. I think it went to $9 million. But it's a completely unaccountable partisan shop in charge of making sure the Conservatives win the next election. And they control the talking points, not just of backbenchers, but now of ministers. Here's an insight from one of my favorite former progressive conservatives, retired Senator Lowell Murray. He wrote these words in the Globe and Mail in September of last year. He called it the Harper government's, which he put in quotes, trademark innovation, a literal trademark, has been to superimpose on the existing centralized system a tightly run communications regime in which message control is the very essence of governance. Under this system, even strong ministers often become passengers on their own departmental ships, their destination and course set by remote control from Message Central at PCO-PMO. Parliament is not even in the picture. At its worst, the system makes ciphers of ministers, reducing from substantive to symbolic the autonomy, authority, and accountability they should exercise. Close quote. Lowell Murray was also in PMO working under Brian Mulroney. I'm so glad I had a chance to work in that government. It wasn't great. Charles has mentioned, you know, on policy issues, we didn't always agree with what the Mulroney administration was doing. I quit on principle over one of those decisions. But cabinet functioned. Ministers made decisions with advice and evidence. Imagine that, evidence-based decision-making. Brian Mulroney took on Ronald Reagan to get acid rain reduced in both countries. It was the top issue bilaterally between Canada and the United States. Brian Mulroney accepted the science of climate change, acid rain, threats to the Great Lakes, the St. Lawrence River. There was a lot done in that period based on evidence and what scientists had to say. The fall of the wall between the Privy Council office, which the chief clerk of Privy Council is in charge of all the deputy ministers, and the operations of a nonpartisan professional civil service that's supposed to do the bidding of their elected masters, yes, but not until Stephen Harper formed a majority in the last election can I find any evidence that ever the civil service was asked to invent evidence to defend a decision that's already been made. So we have moved, you've heard of the gagging of the scientists, we've moved from evidence-based decision-making, it's not my line, I don't know who first said it, but it fits, it's decision-based evidence-making. And it means you can't believe Government of Canada reports anymore. It's the corruption at its core by a political operation that is running everything, and it all emanates out of Prime Minister's office. Well, I thought things had gotten pretty bad, so last fall, when we had another prorogation, I decided to do a cross-country speaking tour on the threat to Canada's democracy, which we called Save Democracy from Politics Tour. I spoke in, I think it was 17 cities and 7 provinces and territories in the time I had when the House was prorogued. And then, I thought, you know, I had a pretty good case that democracy was in trouble. But back to Bruce Coburn, the trouble with normal is it always gets worse. This brings me to Bill C-23, the so-called Fair Elections Act. The Globe and Mail is not a radical newspaper. It is not hostage to the left in this country. It is not prone to quote Pierre Poilievre, although I shouldn't be so cruel and quote him as saying that right now, today in the House, he said that the opposition to C-23 was a lot of hyperbole. I think he meant hyperbole, but these notes are written by others. You can't expect them to pronounce them correctly. C-23 is such an offense that the Globe and Mail has run the last 5 editorials in a row saying this bill must be stopped. It is, at its essence, about elevating the electoral tricks, some of which are legal, such as attack ads, and some of which are illegal, such as robocalls, elevating voter suppression to legislative form by making it harder for people to vote, by removing the vouching provisions from our current electoral laws. That's why Mark Mayrand is the latest in a series of civil service heroes, because he wasn't consulted in advance by political masters. The bill that was brought forward, the so-called Fair Elections Act, and by the way, at every stage so far, debate is being limited and it's being rushed through the House. But it does a number of things. I think the most egregious of them, although there are many things that one could discuss, is removing the vouching provisions. The claim here is that there is a threat to Canadian democracy. Oh, we're agreed on that, all right. There's a threat to Canadian democracy, and it's not the Prime Minister's office. It's not the excessive control of political parties over everything that goes on within that party. The threat to Canadian democracy is rogue Canadian citizens disguising themselves as other people and going out and voting more than once. That, we are to believe, is the threat to Canadian democracy. It's really clear to me from looking at all the evidence that the threat to Canadian democracy is not that Canadians are going out and voting more than once. It's that they're voting less than once. That is the crux of the problem. So Mr. Poilievre's bill, which is massive, by the way, which was brought forward on a Tuesday, and the first vote for a limitation of debates was less than 7 days later. And you know, it's a long bill. It does some things that are okay with me, but basically it's set up a straw man of voter fraud and is going to bring that straw man down by making it harder for Canadians to vote. Now, I never thought as an activist fighting Agent Orange or fighting Budrum spraying, trying to get a climate plan in place in time for my grandchildren to have a livable world, that's that window on that opportunity is closing really fast. I never thought that I would have to be someone who reminded Canadians of our system of government. We live in a Westminster parliamentary democratic system. We live in a constitutional monarchy. We do not elect a prime minister. We elect a House of Commons. The prime minister reports to parliament, not the other way around. Parliament, fundamental principle, parliament controls the public purse, not the prime minister. The budget should give any diligent member of parliament enough information to decide how the money is going to be spent. That's kind of the point of a budget, isn't it? Do you know, I'm on a new campaign that every year's federal budget, as long as Stephen Harper's ministers are cranking them out, they really should not be called a budget. They should be called the annual thick brochure. The annual really, really thick brochure that tells us what the next campaign slogans will be, who's going to be slaughtered and who might be elevated. And it does include some numbers, money spent here and money spent there. But where is, this is another one of my rants, which is a whole chapter in this book, is that the Canadian media has been so overtaken by centralization and control of ownership that we don't have a free and independent media in this country anymore, which is another thing Tom Kent would have told us if he were still alive, because he chaired the Commission of Inquiry, the Royal Commission, into the press in Canada. And he said back in the early 80s that the concentration of ownership in our media was monstrous. That was before Conrad Black set out to buy everything. So in any case, we do have a problem, but where is the media telling us? You all read reports on what the 2014 budget said. Do you recall anybody in any newspaper telling you that there was no statement of total government revenues, no statement of total government expenses, and no bottom line included so that one could consider, is this a budget? Or is this just a big fat brochure? Where is the budget? We used to have budgets. I used to read them. I used to go into lockup and read, how much money did Environment Canada get last year? How much is it getting next year? It's hard to find this information these days. And it's so hard to find where the axe is falling that even though Kevin Page, as parliamentary budget officer, went to court to get the right to that information, and the court ruled that parliamentary budget officer and individual MPs have the right to that information, even with a court challenge and a win, PMO, PCO is not giving us that information. So here we have, back to where I started, a challenge. And it's a challenge to all of us as citizens together. Nobody's going to rescue us from this dragon. We got to rescue ourselves. When Ned Frank said that from now on we should refer to Stephen Harper as King Stephen I of Canada, I look at what's happened with the assembly of power. The levers of power are now all conveniently located on the Prime Minister's desk. So do we really think King Thomas or King Justin, on walking into their palatial offices, will say, "Oh my, this is dangerous, I have too much power"? Now, I happen to like both those guys. They're fine fellows, and they have better policies than the current administration. But I don't want to live in an elected dictatorship. I want to live in a democracy. I'd like a democracy that makes some mistakes. I'd like parliamentarians who actually are allowed to think for themselves, speak to their own knowledge of issues, go into a legislative committee, and actually pass amendments to legislation. That's something that never happened in the Mulroney years, by the way. When I was in Tom McMillan's office and we put forward the Canadian Environmental Protection Act, and Charles will remember it because it dealt with cradle-to-grave toxic chemicals, we accepted massive changes to that legislation put forward by the NDP's Liberal members of Parliament in a committee process that was essentially nonpartisan. The committee process in Parliament, MPs would roll up their sleeves, walk in and figure out, can we improve this legislation? Not anymore. The government members that dominate every single committee are told how to control that bill, shut down every amendment, and they have talking points, and they're also told how to grill witnesses. So we no longer invite expert testimony and treat people respectfully. Sometimes it's really embarrassing how witnesses get treated if they say things that are inconvenient to the government's decision-based evidence making. C-38. Over 440 pages that I've mentioned that eviscerated all our environmental laws, repealed the Kyoto Implementation Act, got rid of the National Roundtable, all the changes that were made there, and changes to pharmaceutical registration, many changes that had nothing to do with the budget. From first reading to royal assent, not a single amendment. That's not democracy. That goes exactly back to Charles's quote from his father, who pointed out that when the House right now simply legitimates what someone else puts before it, or if your father saw what was happening now. We have to organize ourselves to make sure that before the next election campaign, the national media can't tell us what the key issue of the day is. We have to be able, as Canadians, to say, our key issue is the restoration of Canadian parliamentary democracy. We have to... We have to mobilize and support Conservative MP Michael Chong of Wellington Halton Hills, whose bill for reform, Bill C-559, would actually reduce the power of party leaders and reduce the power of Prime Minister. We have to do everything we can to ensure that before the next election, the ballot question isn't which new elected dictator do we want. The ballot question in the next election has to be, do Canadians care about their democracy? Are we willing to fight for it? And will we get it back before it's too late? Thank you.
We have some time for questions, and as the tradition at McGill Institute for the Study of Canada events, the first two questions go to students. So if there are students in the audience, they get the first two questions. We want that on the microphone.
Okay. On the microphone's down here. Sorry about that, the overflow room. You have to walk in here. So if you... Oh, yes.
Hello.
Hi.
My name is Sam. Similarly in Quebec, similarly like in Canada, there's a crisis of democracy in Quebec. Recently in Quebec news, we have learned that several student voters have been disenfranchised. Out-of-province students have been turned away from election offices, being refused the right to register as an elector. To vote in Quebec, you must have lived here for at least 6 months and be domiciled here. The term domicile, as it is defined in the civil code, is so vague that interpretation is often left to agents at the electoral offices. And the interpretation is often negative. These students have lived in Quebec for over 6 months, pay taxes on food and clothes, et cetera, and will probably go on to pursue higher studies and remain here. This isn't democracy. Pauline Marois has even said that it's voter fraud. I assure you that making a democracy more open is not voter fraud. Sorry, yes. Ms. May, don't you think that students who pay tax and have a stake in Quebec should be able to vote here?
Yeah. Sam, thanks for the question. As a federal party leader, I think there's a pretty clear understanding from all of us as federal party leaders. We rarely agree on anything as federal party leaders, which should make me doubt whether it's wise course. But we don't want to interfere in a Quebec election. And for that reason only, I'm not going to answer your question. But I thank you for asking it.
Thank you.
Now, it's been made very, very clear that it's very much, there's a fight on information. So particularly Section 18 of Bill C-23. Should this bill pass unamended, all these provisions to provide information to voters would create a huge vacuum of information. What would you propose for particularly people from lower socioeconomic classes, younger people who will be affected by this lack of information, these mobilization campaigns? What would you suggest to get these people informed, to get them to vote, to counteract this measure?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I today in the House, and I was in the debates before taking off to get here, it's before the House again to try to stop this bill. It will be an ongoing commitment, I think, from all the parties in opposition to try to stop C-23. I hate the thought of even imagining that it would be in place before the next election. Then there would also be, if it should go through unamended, I think there's a significant opportunity for court challenges. Section 3, the right to vote under the Charter, is a sacred right. I mean, and I agree with Charles that being a citizen of democracy isn't a privilege or a right. It's a duty. And so maybe this is what we need. I'm going to be in a panel tomorrow at University of Ottawa with Justin Trudeau and Tom Mulcair and Michael Chong to talk about youth voting. Maybe what we need in a consumer society where people have been lulled and sort of anesthetized into complacency by the idea that if we just all behave ourselves, we can always, you know, get the new flat screen TV and that nothing really matters much, or that we don't vote because politics looks disgusting, or that we're not all that interested. Maybe when it becomes really transparently clear that the apparatus of government has been put to work to stop youth from voting, maybe that's just the impetus we need for people to say, by God, you're not going to stop me from voting. I'm going to vote, and I'm going to find ways to mobilize, and I'm going to bring everybody I know so that youth voter turnout exceeds the voter turnout of those of us, this year I'm turning 60, I don't mind, so those of us old ones are not going to have to live with the results of the horrors that are being done in Parliament these days. Maybe it's just one step too far, and that a lot of people will say, I didn't vote before because I thought that the establishment, the corporatist agenda, wanted the affirmation of a high voter turnout. But now I see the corporatist agenda has been ripped bare and actually wants me as a young person or as a disadvantaged person economically, they actually want me not to be able to vote. So maybe I'm just going to make sure they don't get their wish. So court challenges, mobilization, and don't wait for this bill to pass to mobilize against it. Do everything you can. I know right now that the focus here is on the Quebec election, but do everything you can at the federal level. Pay attention to the online comment sections of media. Write letters to the editor. And as young people, your voice is particularly significant. Tell them if you've ever had trouble getting to vote in the polls the way it is now and how much harder it's going to be if they take away the vouching provisions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. So, second microphone, and then I'll go back in.
Hi, thanks very much for your comments, especially about what you said with the Prime Minister's office basically doing partisan activity. I'm wondering how you feel about the official opposition doing the same thing with the recent allegations of the Montreal and Quebec offices and the recent Saskatchewan office?
Well, I think it's outrageous. I don't care who's misusing public funds and partisan interests. It's outrageous. You just don't mean. I'm, as a member of parliament, I sometimes get complaints in my riding because people have gone into my riding office to try to find out how to join the Green Party. And my office says, I'm sorry, we don't have anything to do with the Green Party here. We don't have forms here. We can't help you here. You know, it's really important to recognize that as parliamentarians, any resources that come from the government of Canada are not to be used for partisan purposes. Now, I'm not prejudging that. It may well be that there's a parliamentary function to locating offices outside of Ottawa. It requires to be established because intuitively that doesn't strike me as particularly likely, but it could be true and I don't rule that out. But if you're using public resources for partisan ends, now Prime Minister's office, by the way, has existed for partisan purposes only, and they use those funds for partisan purposes. They even have, there have been reports in the media of people who've received phone calls from the Conservative Party to donate money to the party saying, I'm calling from the Prime Minister's office. Now, we don't know if they are or they aren't, but given that, as I asked for, as an answer to a question on the order paper, I wanted to see, and asked the Library of Parliament to find out for me, what are the different categories of people who are, how many people work at PMO? How many different employees are there? What are they doing? And I could only get the top, say, 50 or 60 people who were listed there. And I couldn't get all the names. I couldn't get salary levels. And interestingly enough, most of the people listed, once you got below chief of staff and director of communications, they were listed as information officers. And that's, I think it's an Orwellian term for suppressing information. But it's also, by the way, throughout the civil service, it's the only category of government civil service employee that's gone up recently. 15% increase in people described as information officers. Because you have to pay people to be minders, to go to scientific conferences. This is not, I'm not making this up. They actually have people going to the conferences to keep an eye on our leading scientists to make sure they don't do media interviews without approval. Anyway, to your point about the official opposition, if they're misusing public funds, it's appalling. They have to explain where every penny goes. Mm. I do. They can.
Right. Thanks. You.
To you. Thank you.
Okay. Hi, Ms. May. It's an honor to meet you. I'm Rana Al-Rabi. I feel the same way about everything you said about the budget, how it's a thick brochure and the way the media reports on it. I'm curious to know how you feel about the resignation of Jim Flaherty and the appointment of Joe Oliver.
Well, Jim Flaherty was, and it's widely reported, you know, basically every minister in Stephen Harper's government, from the quote that I gave you from Lowell Murray, that they're mere ciphers. This is not any offense towards them as individuals. Some will actually put their oar in and put a personal stamp on things. I distinguish, for instance, Rona Ambrose as one of those. When she took over as Minister of Public Works, she was clearly running the shipbuilding procurement process. It's well run, well managed. She's very competent. She put her own stamp on that. So it's not always the case. But for the most part, I mean, Joe Oliver didn't write his own statements calling environmentalists radicals. That was all out of PMO. And Peter Kent didn't make up that Canada was halfway to the Copenhagen target. That was all PMO. And you get to someone like Jim Flaherty, you think, well, he had a certain Irish charm. He was always, you know, at least willing to be humorous with us in the House as he deflected the questions and avoided answering them. And the other thing about Jim Flaherty was it was at least plausible that he said to Harper, well, you can't do that. Now, he didn't get his own way very often, obviously. Otherwise, in 2008, the financial forecast for Canada would not have projected 4 years of narrow surpluses. Flaherty had to know that had no credibility when he issued it, but apparently also Stephen Harper was one who insisted that in that financial statement they give the first indication that they would get rid of the per-vote subsidy. So the financial statement was what prompted the crisis that nearly, well, crisis or huge hopeful opportunity for the rest of us, that Stephen Harper might actually no longer be Prime Minister and be supplanted by a perfectly legal coalition of the parties that represented more Canadian voters. Anyway, with Jim Flaherty leaving, the reality is that Joe Oliver will continue to do what Joe Oliver did when he was Minister of Natural Resources, which is whatever Stephen Harper says. So I really don't think it matters much. There's no change of ministry or cabinet shakeup in this particular context in which it matters much, because the Prime Minister's office controls everything. And it's really, people accuse, well, now the Green Party's doubled, as you know, there's two of us, so this no longer really holds, but people used to accuse me of being a party of one. But really, the only party of one around here is the Conservatives.
Thanks for your lecture, Ms. May. You had touched on corporatism, and I have a question about that. It seems to me that a lot of the laws and programs and policies being pursued by this government, everything from immigration policy to environmental policy, has really been in the service of corporations and under the guise of protecting our economy, which is really just in service of really aggressive corporations. And so I'm wondering if you think that capitalism as we have it today and democracy are compatible.
That's a great question. What's your name?
My name is Malek Yalawi.
Malek Yalawi.
I'm a poli sci grad, but I work at McGill now.
Wow. I don't know if you look at Schumpeter and the sort of the capitalist, the post-capitalist cycles that could happen in terms of the, sort of right before capitalism, as it's circling the drain, it moves to corporatism. I'm not a big, I don't have a problem with capitalism per se. I have a problem with capitalism when governments aren't properly regulating, paying attention, making sure that public services like rail safety is paid attention, food safety. There's an essential role for good governance in any democracy. That's the core goal is that government protect the public from a number of threats, one of which is the rapaciousness of corporate greed. So if you're not prepared to stop the rapaciousness of corporate greed, in fact, if you celebrate it, if you say, as Jim Flaherty did, we must reduce taxes on the job creators. Now there's a stretch. The job creators now, so-called, the job creators being private sector in Canada, has $600 billion in bank accounts that former Governor of Bank of Canada, Mark Carney, called dead money. That is the equivalent of 32% of our GDP in bank accounts sloshing around. It is not job creating, no sir, it is absolutely dead money. That's the result of deciding to put our corporate tax rate lower than any other country in the industrialized world. Now, you can make a good case as a civic-minded, parliamentary, pro-capitalist MP that we should make sure our tax rates are competitive so that we don't see a flight of corporate money and corporate capital to other countries. But why would you peg your corporate tax rate at the lowest in the industrialized world and then see the excess profits made by U.S.-based corporations go to taxation in the U.S. instead of being, you know, we have a lot of public service operations that are in crisis, not the least of which is Environment Canada regulation based on increasing cuts, but also food safety, but also rail safety. There are places we need to regulate. So I don't think that capitalism and democracy are incompatible. But I think the capitalist triumphalism at the end of the Cold War that said that capitalism has won and communism has lost, well, guess where capitalism has taken root very happily is in People's Republic of China. They used to celebrate capitalism as somehow the values of capitalism were inherently aligned with respect for human rights and diversity and democracy and caring for each other. Well, it's now apparent to anyone with eyes to open that capitalism is very happy with dictatorships. They're predictable. My goodness, the markets hate it when things are unpredictable, and democracies are inherently messy. They're hard work, and they're unpredictable. So capitalism isn't the problem. Surrendering governance to corporate rule is the problem. Okay. I'm being held to two more questions.
Okay. Undoubtedly, democracy under Harper has been worsening. But the situation predates the Harper government. Mm-hmm. It's been declining for at least 30 years. Mm-hmm. Average income has gone down. Inequality has increased. We have increasing more problems in health and medical fields, in education.
I'm asking for the question.
I'm suggesting that Canadians as a whole have lost faith in the democratic process, and they see no real difference in any of the major parties. So how do you get out of that situation?
Well, I think, number one, I won't disagree that these are trends. That was my first point. And the trends haven't been good for a while. But it's all recently, things are alarmingly worse. So to get out of the situation, number one, we have to shake the main parties out of their willingness to adopt the same techniques that Stephen Harper's been using. I mean, let's be clear. Susan Delacourt's new book, Shopping for Votes, goes through the history of how this has happened, how it's possible for people to realize, people being the spin doctors in the back rooms of all the main parties, I'm not leaving any of them out, they all have this particular group of spin doctory types who live to win without really caring why. And that's a dangerous thing in a democracy. And then the tools to win become, as Susan Delacourt's book, Shopping for Votes, they've been picked up by a lot of what's been going on in the U.S. Hyperpartisanship, emotive-based messaging as opposed to evidence-based thoughtful discourse, respect for everybody, love for everybody. This kind of thing is anathema to the conquer, divide, fear factory approach that comes from the U.S. Republican Tea Party and which has been picked up here in Canada. So we have to make sure that the other parties stop playing the same games. We have to make sure that Canadians start saying, I'm less interested in the leader of the party who's and having my candidate locally be a cardboard cutout of the leader of the party with a message track that might as well be a tape player in the back of their cardboard neck that spits out the message during election campaigns. That's what the media also prizes in political leadership. If you have people in your caucus who speak out and have their own ideas, somehow that's a sign that you're not effective as a leader. I mean, this is not just one person or one event that's created a nightmarish set of circumstances for a real democracy. But it's got to come to, yeah, if Canadians think, oh, well, they're all the same, well, number one, they're not all the same. Number two, the differences have to be more than skin deep, which means we have to really shake up Tom Mulcair and Justin Trudeau. That they have to get behind Michael Chong's bill. They have to get Michael Chong's bill passed. They have to show that they're serious. This is not something that's going to be easy, but we can do it before the next election if we can get Michael Chong's bill passed.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, let's go. Okay, yes, you were waiting the longest.
Good evening, and thank you so much, Elizabeth. I think you're a saint for sitting in Parliament with Harper. I'm just wondering, my greatest fear is that this horrible government will be elected again. And I'm just wondering what it is we can do. Shouldn't we be looking forward to a coalition government? Because talking about a majority government with 39.5% is an aberration. So what would you suggest that we do?
Okay, the first thing I want to tell you is how much I love being a parliamentarian. I don't have to be a saint to sit there. Actually, and I say this publicly because it will shock you, but it's worth knowing. Most of my colleagues, the people I work with every day, regardless of what party badge they wear when they get elected, are wonderful people. They're lovely people. They care about their community. That's why they ran for office. Some of them are shocked once they get elected to find out that their job is to read from a script and not to get out of line. So they may not be the bravest of people, but the system is designed to punish them severely if they act up, right? So they're good people. And I don't have any problem standing in Parliament with Stephen Harper. It's not him I mind. It's all his policies. You know, sometimes he's in a good mood and we have a little chat. So, you know, it's not him. It's everything that he's doing, which is a separate matter. We have to make sure before the next election that the issue is democracy, number one. I'll do everything I can because the mandate from the Green Party to me as leader is to get the other parties to be willing to talk about cooperation with the goal of getting rid of first past the post. I keep trying, I'll keep trying forever. If I can't get them to listen, if I can't get Justin Trudeau and Tom Mulcair to be willing to talk about cooperation with each other or with Greens or with anybody, then I have to hope that in the next election, I'm able somehow or other to communicate to grassroots Canadians who care about the same issues, here's what we got to do. You want to get the parliament you really want? You want to make sure we have enough Greens to have a balance of power in the next election? We might have a minority parliament. Wouldn't that be cool? So here's how we're going to do it. I don't know how we're going to actually make that happen in the next election, but I think that I know it's possible because Canadians are desperately concerned with what they see happening to our country, whether the main concern is health care or your main concern is what's happening to trade union rights or what's happening to immigration and refugee rights. Everywhere you look across the political spectrum, You can't describe it as different policies. It can only be described as vandalism. What's happening to our libraries? What's happening to our scientists? This is vandalism. To rebuild that, we can't continue the mindless partisanship that treats politics as a blood sport of my team versus your team, and you're always wrong and I'm always right. It's got to stop, and it starts with cooperation. And if they won't cooperate with me, I'll just have to keep cooperating with them till they give up. Thank you. It gives me a great deal of pleasure to be able to thank our speaker, Elizabeth May, today for her passionate and thought-provoking lecture, and also to thank her for her passionate, inspiring example of engaged citizenship. And this is a very small token from the Institute.
Thank you. Yeah.
She said I could open it in front of you. See, the thing is, oh, wow, it's books. It's three books. Oh, stories and, oh, it's a three-volume set of the voices and images of Nunavummiut. That's beautiful. Thank you. And it's, I just, you know, not that you have to get me anything, but June 9th, I turned 60. I just thought I'd mention that. I'm the oldest party leader. I'm really chuffed about it. Okay, that's it for me. Thank you.